Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Patrick Wheeler. I'm Assistant City Attorney for the City and County of Denver, representing the Denver Public Trustee in this matter. The fundamental facts are pretty basic. This involves a garnishment that was served by the appellee's client on the public trustee seeking to garnish overbid funds from a public foreclosure sale that had occurred. There are other facts, but they're not terribly pertinent to what issues are being raised on this appeal. And the view of the public trustee, this appeal represents a fundamental conflict between Colorado foreclosure law and garnishment law. The Denver public trustee asserts that she should not be required to comply with a writ of garnishment served on her when to do so would require her to act contrary to the clear mandates of foreclosure law. In order to assure the proper and fair administration of foreclosure law, it is imperative that the statutory process foreclosure not be disrupted or overridden by a separate and incompatible debt collection process. As noted in the public trustee's opening brief, the overbid funds arising from the foreclosure sale are held by the public trustee in a custodial capacity under Section 3837.113.2 of the Colorado Revised Statutes. She is obligated to distribute the overbid funds in accordance with Section 3838.111 of the Colorado Revised Statutes. There is no provision in the foreclosure law for such overbid funds to be subject to a separate debt collection such as garnishment, execution, or attachment. Indeed, the only debt process expressly recognized as being allowed to intercede and modify the foreclosure process is federal bankruptcy, and there's a specific statute to that effect. Garnishment and execution or attachment, none of those are mentioned at all in the foreclosure statutes.
Position that a garnishment can never be served with respect to overbid funds on the public trustee, or that a garnishment cannot be served by what you term here as a junior liener on the overbid funds?
Well, in typical situations, it is a junior liener. In this case, that creates a double reason to not allow for it. But yes, Your Honor, I would take the position that garnishment is just basically incompatible with foreclosure law, because foreclosure law is very precise about what is required of the public trustee in performing her duties.
So even if we conclude PCF is not a junior liener, although that's how you argued in your brief,
yes,
you would still take the position that no garnishment could ever be served on funds held by a public trustee?
That would be my position, but on the other point you made, they've acknowledged that they were essentially a junior liener who was not qualified to redeem.
How did they so acknowledge that?
In the briefs and arguments that were made. It's in the record, Your Honor.
In terms of the foreclosure, they had no ability to participate because of the date of their judgment. Isn't that true?
That's true, Your Honor. And
so in terms of the foreclosure action, they're not a liener at all. They're not involved in that process in any way, shape, or form, isn't that true?
Under 3838.302, they're regarded as being a junior liener, but they're not allowed to redeem if the lien is not recorded after the date of the filing of the notice of election and demand. It still regards them as a junior liener.
What's the statute again?
3838.302. It's the redemption statute.
So I'm clear. PCF did not have a security interest in the real estate upon which the foreclosure occurred, correct? They had no security interest in the real estate, right?
And technically, none of the redeeming parties typically have a secured interest, because it's not a deed of trust. It's not something that the property owners voluntarily entered into. It's usually an involuntary judgment. And to the extent that the statute gives them the right to redeem, I guess that does create some kind of a secured right.
The date that the foreclosure occurred, PCF did not have a judgment against, I forget the person's name, but the former owner of the property, right?
That's correct. The appellee maintains that this garnishment would not interfere with the foreclosure process because the garnishment is only being sought with respect to the distribution of overbid funds to the property owner, which occurs at the very end of the foreclosure process. It is probably about the last step there is in the foreclosure process when there's an overbid. You know, what they're saying is true, but the distribution of the public trustee, that distribution of the public trustee to the property owner is still part of the foreclosure process. It's spelled out right in the statute, 3838.111.2, that's what the public trustee is obligated to do, is distribute the money to the property owner.
At that point in time, you're holding it as a custodian for the property owner.
That's correct.
And all you have left to do is write a check and put it in the mail. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Then how does this garnishment interfere with your foreclosure process?
Well, it may not in this particular case, but the logical conclusion of what the appellee is asking for is that garnishment would be applicable throughout at any stage of the foreclosure. And there's numerous stages in the foreclosure process for which the public trustee is holding funds in a custodial capacity.
Those aren't the facts of our case, are they?
No, but if the court should rule in his favor, this is going to create an invitation to people to seek foreclosure. I mean, I guess the court could always write a very narrow opinion in this situation, but if it wasn't narrow...
You've been known to do that
before. If it's not that way, we could find ourselves having to deal with a very unfortunate situation of getting foreclosures during cure, during the times that we have a bidder at sale who's...
Garnishments, do you mean? You said foreclosure, but you...
I'm sorry, garnishments at the time of cure, at the time of...
You could answer at those points that there's no funds to be held because there are no funds being held for the benefit of the garnishee. Not the garnishment.
Well, that definitely would be. I mean, if whoever's entitled to get the money could be subject to a garnishment. It could be a bank. It could be a private individual. It could be any number of parties who are involved in the foreclosure process who are entitled to those custodial funds.
Once the redemption period runs, then the only function is to distribute the money. Why is the trustee any different than a bank or any other holder of custodial funds?
But then that's my question is, why aren't they then subject when they hold cure funds or when they get money at a bid at sale or when they get redemption funds? I mean, all of that's custodial funds in their hands that they have to distribute to the appropriate parties. So at each of those stages, they could be subject to garnishment. Now, I want to admit that this has been fairly uncommon. I mean, I've done this for 20 years almost, and...
That's one you've seen? Huh? It's the first one you've seen?
No, I've seen a few others, but in the past, I've always been fortunate enough to talk to the attorneys who were threatening to do garnishment out of out of doing it and suggesting alternative ways to deal with the deal, like letting them know when we're about to hand the money over to the party to whom they wish to obtain the money from. And we're always willing to assist in that regard. We don't want to deny them their rights under the law to collect the money.
Counsel, you must admit that all judgment debtors aren't real anxious to turn the money over to the creditor. You know, and if he grabs a check, goes out the door, and runs to Guatemala, they're not going to get their money, are they?
Well,
that's the reason we have the garnishment law, so that they can attach the funds before they get to the debtor.
You're maybe right, Your Honor, but again, there are broader consequences to this situation. To be truthful, we really haven't been here a few years ago. There was a change in the statutes on foreclosure law that up till a few years ago, anybody who had a junior lien was entitled to redeem. And in fact, was obligated to redeem if they wanted to preserve their lien against the property as a secured lien. They changed the law a few years ago and said, if you didn't record it prior to the NED, the Notice of Election and Demand, then you were... you're going to be out of luck. You couldn't exercise it here. Just for the record, I objected to that change. I said that's not a good change. It was just something for the foreclosure attorneys to make it easier on them because they didn't have to keep track of who had a recorded lien against the property. But the result has been what we're facing today, which is somebody in this appellee's very position, which they would have been able to in years past, in fact, would have been obligated to do a redemption rather than do a garnishment. Now we're at the question I always had is what happens now that these people are not allowed to redeem? And the question has not been answered, short of getting a garnishment. I'm not too happy about that result because I think that that could, if we did allow garnishments to continue to occur, it's going to become a real burden upon public trustees going forward. In fact, it could start increasing the number of garnishments. And then you get into all kinds of potential conflicts, multiple garnishments like there was in this particular case. There was more than one garnishment that was involved. Fortunately, the judge in that garnishment ruled in our favor and denied the right to garnish. But it's been very awkward trying to figure out how we're going to deal with this if we start getting multiple garnishments. That's the reason why we're here today.
So you took that position. I think you took that position before the legislature, and they didn't accept your position, right?
I don't think the legislature was very well aware of what was happening. And then these things are written by usually foreclosure attorneys. and when they did draft it, I raised my objections.
What's your objection?
I did object to them.
Is there that legislative history?
Well, I'm not necessarily legislative history. I just want you to know that I'm not happy about that, too. I think it led to the reason why we're here today. I don't think if we had had, if redemption was still allowed for all juniors up to the date of sale, they would have been required to redeem. Yes, well, and that one was actually also after. I mean, it was exactly the same position as this garnishee, or garnishor. She just took my arguments, which and accepted them and ruled in my favor.
Is that case pending?
No. They did not elect to appeal. A copy of that decision was attached to my opening brief. And I'm not, basically the arguments were identical. I made this actually, it's almost identical argument in both cases, except in the second one, I acknowledged the first case had already occurred and we had been ruled against. So at this juncture, I'm just wanting to, you know, point out that, you know, there are some consequences. Multiple garnishments could occur. A public trustee would have to deal with that, sort those out.
Does it satisfy the public trustee's concern if there's multiple garnishments? Why can't you just interplead the money to the court?
Well, and we've offered that in the past. In fact, we offered it in this case. But that was not what was agreed to. Instead, the judge who entered the judgment decided to uphold his judgment and to require us to honor the garnishment. Yes. But as noted in the briefs, there was multiple parties who could have laid a claim to the money, and I did offer to interplead it, but that was rejected. Well, both the attorney for the appellee and the judge. The judge didn't address that, but he was in my pleadings.
You're not required to get someone's permission to bring the interpleader action, are you?
Well, when I was called into a hearing before the judge in this case, and he directed us to deposit the money into the court registry, I didn't quite see the point of filing an interpleader.
Well, I understand at that point, but in this list of horribles that you give us, if you have multiple claims on the money, why can't you just, you know, without talking to anybody, just file your interpleader, dump the money into the court, and say, we're done?
That's possible, but again, I did not feel inclined to want to defy a judge who had ordered me at a hearing.
I'm not talking about this case. Once the court tells you what to do, I understand you're required to do that. But in going forward, where you say, if we decide against you here, it will create these multiple claims upon money in your possession, public trustee's possession, why can't you then use interpleader to get yourself out of the middle and end your involvement in the case?
I don't deny that that's a possibility, and we would be willing to go that route. My only concern about that is a cost, the cost of filing an interpleader. The courts don't let us file cases for free. We would have to get notice. We'd have to do an owners and an encumbrance to determine who has an encumbrance against the property, a lien, and then send notice to all of them before we could walk out of the case. And that would be a fairly substantial expense. I guess one other point I would want to make is the garnishment process allows for a private collection of an unsecured debt, and it's interceding basically into a secured creditor's system of foreclosure. So, you know, again, I guess we could always argue that the secured creditors always come first, but There's also an argument to be made that, you know, there's all kinds of arguments that could possibly be made against us in that situation. I guess if we interplead it, we don't have to deal with those arguments. But again, we just, that's just one other point. I mean, it's, there's been a lot of issues that have come up in this. I won't go through them. A lot of them are discussed in my brief of issues we that we anticipate having to deal with. And I don't think they're just a parade of horribles. I think they really are going to be a realistic factor because of two factors. One is the change in the statute I mentioned, and the other is the fact that foreclosure sales are becoming extremely popular now, and a lot of parties are coming, investors are coming up there and bidding up the sales, and thus we have very large overbids. Overbids have become a much more common feature of foreclosure sales, and as such, we anticipate that this could well lead to more garnishment efforts being made. If, you know, we really don't want to have to face that, but if indeed the court is of the view that we should have to face that, then we'd like to have some direction so that my clients would know what, you know, what to expect and when they're required to do this, or maybe when we need to go file an interpleader. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Douglas Katavi, number 14641, and I represent TCF Equipment Finance Company. Thank you for the opportunity today. I think Judge Richman pegged the ultimate issue in this case. Is the public trustee exempt from complying with garnishment law? That's really the elephant in the living room. I also think, based upon the opening, I'm going to very briefly touch on a couple of the facts as it relates to the judgment lien holder. The foreclosure was commenced on June 22, 2011. That's done through a document called an NED, a Notice of Election and Demand. TCF got judgment about 3 weeks later on July 13th, 2011. Under current foreclosure law, if TCF takes that judgment, gets a transcript of judgment and records it, it cannot participate in the underlying foreclosure as a junior lien holder because the NED predates the judgment. So TCF, as Judge Nieto pointed out, TCF was not a junior lien holder within the context of this foreclosure. TCF then...
Hold on a second.
Yes, sir.
Statute says a liener holding a lien that is not entitled to redeem by virtue of being recorded after the notice of election demand shall not have any claim to any portion of the overbid.
Under the foreclosure statute.
So your client, you would say, was a liener holding a lien that was not entitled to redeem? Well, they didn't record, I guess is the difference. They didn't record after the
notice. They didn't record.
And therefore, they don't have the claim to the overbid.
Under the foreclosure statute.
And your position is under the garnishment statute and garnishment rules, they do have a claim to an overbid.
That's precisely correct.
So is there a conflict between these two statutes?
No, they actually harmonize, Your Honor.
Explain to us.
Absolutely, sir. First of all, Colorado, as pointed out in my brief under the Hudson v. American Founders case, Colorado recognizes all non-exempt property may be subject to debt payment, longstanding principle. Concept number two, under Rule 103, the garnishment law. Section 2A makes very clear the broad nature of personal property subject to garnishment. By definition, garnishment means property in a third party's hands. Rule 103, Section 13, expressly allows garnishment of a public body, which includes a public trustee. And fourth, and I apologize for not having the citation in my brief, CRS 13-61-101 is titled Funds subject to garnishment and is directed at a public entity or body, quote, having the control of the dispersing of any fund, end quote. This statute, 1361-101, allows garnishment. So, appellee submits that Colorado law does allow garnishment of a public trustee. The next question is timing, and did my client act within the law from a procedural standpoint? Because the appellate brings up a number of potential problems regarding when that garnishment might hit, both in the context of cure funds, potential redemption funds. So there's a real timing question involved. TCF always wanted to avoid any interference with the underlying workings of the public trustee foreclosure. And in fact, the trial court noted as much on page 179 and 180 of the record. We did not try and immediately garnish funds after the sale of the property. Nor did we move out of Rule 103 into the context of an execution and march the sheriff into the public trustee's office to take a physical seizure, which is how you perfect under a writ of execution, is physically take possession of the property. That would have caused nothing but problems. And what we concluded was this foreclosure, again, recognizing that TCF could not proceed as a junior lien holder within the statute. We did not want to try and upset the apple cart, gain a preferred position, or otherwise operate outside the statute, what the statutory intent of the foreclosure statute was.
Wasn't that just a coincidence here? Because there was no junior liener who was at that point seeking those funds. The only person left was the former property owner. Had there been a junior liener, there would have been a conflict, and the trustee would have had to resolve between priorities or however you want to call it that.
In conversations, I think you're correct, Judge. I don't believe there was another junior lien holder. If there was, it was for a somewhat de minimis amount. But by the time the garnishment was served and I was in contact with the public trustee's office, I made it abundantly clear that we were not trying to get in front of anyone or the lawful operations of the public trustee, and had a junior lien holder existed, they essentially would have trumped us. And that's the way it works in creditor law sometimes. So what TCF did was allow...
Trumps you by virtue of the foreclosures.
Absolutely.
So there really don't need to be, there doesn't need to be an interpleader in that case. They just pay the lien holder, and the garnisher, I guess it's called, is out of luck if there aren't enough funds.
Correct. You're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct, because the creditor ought not be able to gain advantage through a clever tactic from something that it was prohibited to do by the very statute it's trying to access. Before I forget, while the interpleader issue comes up, the garnishment came, and the underlying action came out of courtroom 275, and perhaps I'm just not clever enough on my underlying civil procedure. I just don't understand why a new action with a new case number and interpleader needs to be created. And the garnishment came out of 275, and I would have had no problem with the money being deposited in courtroom 275's court registry. And that judge, Judge Mullins, who issued the garnishment, whose clerk issued the garnishment, could take the matter up. But getting back to my points, once the foreclosure was completed and all the redemption periods expired, only one thing needed to be done, and that was sign a check and give it to the property owner, Mr. Matthew Gold. And it's at that point that we think the express purpose of Rule 103, garnishments are only there for property being held in a third-party hands. That's why we think it's appropriate for a creditor, once the operation of the foreclosure has run its course, that a creditor can then garnish this overbid, because the alternative is no remedy at all for the judgment creditor. You can't give the money to the judgment debtor from the public trustee and then expect the creditor to have any recourse against that judgment debtor. That money's going to disappear, and the creditor is going to be denied a remedy. And that's just the real world solution on the way it is. The appellant also complains about the administrative burden of processing garnishments. As a creditor's attorney, I hear that every day. Nobody likes creditor's attorneys, and nobody likes the administrative headache of processing garnishments. Not employers on the route of continuing garn, not a bank on a similar garnishment served on a bank or another financial institution. They're pains. Nobody likes it. But it's just an area where that's the way the Colorado system has been set up. And some people do need a little more encouragement paying their debts than others. So safeguards do exist under the current circumstance, under the law, and we believe the existing law harmonizes, especially in the application to these facts. We stayed out of the public trustee foreclosure, and a worst-case scenario is simply depositing the money in the court registry and letting the people with an interest in that fund and the judge who issued the garnishment sort through the facts. So,
hypothetical, I know it doesn't apply here, but in the hypothetical situation you just talked about, if the person serves the garnishment, if the creditor serves the garnishment and it's too late because it's after the date of the notice of election, he can't participate in the foreclosure, isn't he in a sense reviving his status if it ends up in an interpleader? He couldn't participate in the foreclosure because his judgment came after the notice of election demand. But if he serves the garnishment afterward and there's other competing interests for those funds, in effect he would have to be treated like a junior leaner in the interpleader action. Although I guess your answer would be he doesn't get anything because he's last in line.
Well, if there's other junior lien holders in your hypothetical, I think those junior lien holders trump the garnishing creditor.
In an interpleader case.
I don't even think.
You don't need.
Yes, but I think it's not, you don't even perhaps need to get to the interpleader stage logically. You may go that route just to be safe, so you're not deciding somebody's, so a public trustee's not deciding substantive rights, but you're correct. The junior lien holder under that example would trump the garnishing creditor.
What if there's multiple garnishing creditors?
Again, the junior lien holder.
No junior lien holder, just okay. A bunch of multiple garnishing.
Right, and that's an issue for the garnishing court, but generally, first in time, first in right, like our recording system, is a pretty good, a pretty safe bet. Who served their garnishment first?
That's an administrative. There might be an administrative burden on the trustee, like it is on. But that's like on any employer, any bank, any.
But it's a bank. If there's several creditors chasing a guy, and they figure out he's got an affirmative at Chase or Wells Fargo, everybody's going to rush to get a garnishment in place. Wells Fargo's not going to know what to do because they get hit with multiple garnishments. They'll just tender the funds to the court and say, you guys figure it out, they're out of it.
Interpleaders. Okay. More funds for the court, I guess.
So we respectfully request the decision of the trial court to defer. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for fine arguments. The case will stand submitted and opinion will issue in due course.